compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And away we go into hour three of the Patrick Madrid Show. You know how things work. Give me a call with your question. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go. By the way, this is funny and stupid at the same time. It's funny because it's stupid. This is an example of how stupid things are getting. Cyrus, you have a tract home, right? You live in a neighborhood, don't you?
I do live in a neighborhood.
Yeah. You're not like out on the prairie or anything.
No,
and
no.
We live in a residential
home.
Okay. Does your home have a master bedroom?
It does. Yeah. Yeah, we have a master bedroom. It's great.
Well, you are not woke, because if you wake up in your master bedroom, this, by the way, an article from the New York Post, you apparently are not woke. Following the lead of several U.S. realty groups, the Toronto Regional Real Estate Board announced last week that it's going to stop referring to the master bedroom because of the words ties to slavery, as well as racist and sexist. This is how dumb this is getting.
I will check my privilege.
Instead, they're going to use the word primary. That will be used when describing the main or principal bedroom in the home, according to the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Primary bedroom, that means that the other bedrooms are not primary, and therefore they're secondary, so my children are secondary? I'm just following the...
No, you're good to do this. It's important to try to understand the logic. But in this case, there really is no good logic here. It's because they use the term master with regard to the bedroom in the house, and they say, well, yeah, but in slavery, which is horrible, I mean, it doesn't need to be said, but I guess maybe we should say it for the sake of people understanding. We completely reject and denounce slavery as evil, no question about that. But this is so silly, because the bedroom in your home has nothing to do with the peculiar institution of slavery. And yet, they're going to avoid the word because it just, I guess, triggers people too much. I don't think it really does, but they're insisting. So the president of this real estate board, Lisa Patel, she said in a statement, what this will mean for the consumer and realtors is that property listings will now reference primary, where it used to reference master as the main or principal bedroom. The U.S. has seen a reckoning over the term master bedroom over the past year in the wake of George Floyd's death and resulting Black Lives Matter protests. In July, the Houston Association of Realtors announced it would stop using the word on its listings database in favor of primary bedroom or primary bathroom.
Dum, 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 dum.
Yeah. Exactly. That's just the word I was looking for. The change came after several years of review prompted by members of the association who asked for the use of the term to be looked at. A statement from this realtor group said the overarching message was that some members are concerned about how terms might be perceived by other agents and consumers. I don't think anybody ever, anywhere, was offended that the house was listed as having a master bedroom, until somebody suggested that maybe somebody might be offended. Why would you be offended by that? Why would you be offended? I mean, what about your master's degree? Maybe academia needs to get on the stick. Mind blown, Cyrus?
Yeah.
Mind blown?
Wow.
Maybe academia needs to just do away with the master's degree, because after all, slavery. Are they getting a degree in slavery? No. Are they learning how to run a slave operation? No, it has nothing to do with any of that. So if the kooky realtors are so up in arms about the phrase master bedroom to the point where they won't even use it anymore, I think maybe Harvard and Princeton and UCLA and all the other schools should take a long, hard look at their master's programs and maybe get rid of them, because slavery. This is how dumb it's getting. It's getting dumb outside, Cyrus. Wouldn't you agree?
I think the song
says it all. This song really does say it all when it comes to the silliness that we're dealing with nowadays.
Unbelievable.
All right. Well, this show will go on.
Good thing I've got a primary degree. It doesn't have the same...
I'm trying to figure out what could be wrong with the bachelor's degree. Maybe... some people who did bad things at some point were bachelors. and never got married. That means we should not have the term bachelor degree because of that. Is that, hey, do you think that's plausible?
Let's just cancel one word at a time today, Patrick.
I'm telling you, though, I think I'm onto something. If the real estate geniuses no longer will use the word the phrase master bedroom because of slavery, then I'm serious. How can academia with a straight face continue to grant master's degrees? I don't see it. The silence is deafening, Cyrus.
I don't know how to add to that.
Well, I mean, think of all the other things. I'm trying to think of what some of the other things are that we use on a regular basis that involve the word master. And, you know, we'll probably have to rethink all of those things. We'll have to get rid of all those things. But I really think the master's degree is where we should start. Yeah. Let's just call it, well, we can't call it a primary degree, though, can we? Because that would be your bachelor's degree.
Right. I don't know.
Yeah. That's a tough one.
Or maybe we just stop canceling everything.
Oh, they'll never do that. As long as they can, they will. That's for sure. All right. Well, that's a little quotient of silliness for the day. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Trinity in Albuquerque. Hello, Trinity.
Hi, Mr. Madrid. So I have a question about the scapular.
Okay.
Mary said to a saint, I think, I forget which one it was, but she said that if you die with a scapular on, then you'll go to heaven. Mm-hmm. And I just need a bit of clarification on that.
Okay. I think you're referring to St. Simon Stock in what Our Lady revealed to him about the brown scapular of Our Lady Mount Carmel. One of the promises attached to wearing the scapular in faith, you know, it's not a good luck charm, it's not a magic amulet or anything like that, but it's a sign of your devotion to Our Lady, the way like a wedding ring is. It's a sign. It doesn't make you married, but it's a sign of your commitment to your husband, or vice versa, the husband to his wife. And so when worn in faith as a reminder to oneself of your devotion to Our Lady, one of the promises attached to it is that she would intercede in a very particular way, asking God to hasten the departure from purgatory. If the person has to go to purgatory before entering into heaven, that she would pray in a special way that that person would go to heaven quickly. And her prayers are very powerful, obviously. So that's one of them. Another one would be that those who wear the scapular as a sign of faith, that they would go to heaven, but not because of wearing the scapular. In other words, wearing the scapular would be an indication of the fact that you have a great love for Jesus and a devotion to his mother, and you're asking her to pray for you. And when you ask her to pray for you, she will pray for you. So it's not that you go to heaven because you're wearing a scapular, but wearing a scapular would be a sign that you have that devotion, that God grants you the grace to be able to go to heaven. Does that clarify it a little bit?
Yeah. Yes.
Good. I also want to congratulate you. You sound like you are young. Forgive me if I think you're younger than you are, but you were raised right by your parents, and you refer to somebody as Mr. Madrid. I think that's excellent and praiseworthy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You weren't expecting that, were you?
No.
Yeah. Well, I want to compliment you on that, and I appreciate the call. Anything more to this, Trinity, or did we get it?
You answered it.
Good. Okay. Well, enjoy, and thanks for the phone call. Let's go to Cheryl now in Canada. Hi, Cheryl.
Well, hello there, Patrick.
Hi there. You're not calling from the master bedroom, are you? I mean the primary bedroom, as they say in Canada.
That was going to be my joke.
Oh, sorry.
I had it all planned. I was.
Oh,
like,
go ahead. Let's pretend I never said it. Hi, okay, Cheryl in Canada. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Patrick. I'm from Newfoundland, Canada, actually. It's the land of, you know, we got lots of fish and crab, but yet I'm not a master mariner. Nor am I calling from my master bedroom.
because that's wrong in Canada. They won't let you do that. I get it.
Yeah, no,
good
there
joke.
There are master mariners here. There are. Yeah, and I don't have a master's degree or a bachelorette degree. I have a bachelor's degree.
Oh,
so. But well, that's a conversation.
You're in no danger if you don't have a master's degree. They won't come for you.
No. So I had to insert what a dumb joke because I am quite nervous because I'm calling about an issue that is making me lose sleep, making me nervous.
Oh, it's, okay.
It's, as you know, it's wedding season, and you're getting all these wedding questions. Mm-hmm. So a couple weeks ago...
Are you getting married?
My cousin... No, I'm married, and okay. I've been married for 7 years, and I have 4 children.
Congratulations. So, any of them named Patrick?
We're doing well. No, my dad's middle name is Patrick, though, but Patrick is definitely up there. We got a Joseph. Our most recent one is James and Joseph, so they can hold a candle to the name Patrick. But I'm calling because my cousin slash one of my best friends who I've grew up with, went through communion with, and known her forever, university, mm-hmm. lived with her during university, and she asked me to be a bridesmaid for her outdoor backyard wedding.
Yeah.
And
she's a Catholic.
Immediately just, she is on paper, you know, like I said, we did communion and confirmation mm-hmm. together, and I think the last time she was in church was my twins' baptism.
Mm-hmm.
So... And I can't blame COVID for that. She's just, you know, like I said, it's Catholic on paper. And she still claims to be Catholic. But, you know, so many people here in Newfoundland, and that's probably the case in many places in the world, they don't truly know what Catholicism is, you know.
Right.
They don't know the sacraments. They don't know, you know, that sin actually drives us away from Jesus. And so I felt very obligated to tell her that... I'm sorry, and I love you, and I love your fiancé, and I'm rooting for you, I'm praying for you, and I think you got what it takes to make it as a couple, but I cannot stand by you during a non-valid ceremony. I can't smile and pretend it's okay when I know it's not.
Yeah.
And I wish that conversation went as pleasant as this conversation is going, but...
How did it go? What did she say?
Well, I was a basket case. I was like a typical like soap opera crazy star, just like crying and hyperventilating and saying, I'm sorry about this. I love you so much, and blubbering. And she said, wow. She said, I can't believe that you think it's a lie just because it's not inside a Catholic church.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I told her it's not about that. I said, like, I know you guys are awesome for each other and you're great. And I want to see you married. I said, but I want to see you married where you're actually performing a sacrament between you and John and God, where you can still receive the Eucharist and you're not in a state. And then, in retrospect, I'm like, she probably doesn't even realize that when I said the Eucharist, I'm talking about communion, you know? She's that far removed from the church that doesn't even... jive with her. I don't think she even realizes that living with him before marriage means that she can't receive the Eucharist. She's not at that level in her faith.
How did it end up? What was the net result?
Well, she didn't say I hate you,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't much better than that in regards mm-hmm. to ending it. It was, she started to get a bit bitter and said, you know, I hope when your children are married that you're going to be able to support them. And I said, no, Candace, this is the point of this, is I don't want to set the example for my kids to say that I do approve of a wedding that's outside of our church. I want my children to know right from day one that if they're going to get married, to get my support and my husband's support, it will need to be a valid Catholic marriage. I said, and that's the whole point of this. I can't be okay with some people. And
it would be hypocritical.
And I said, and I love you just as much as a child. So, and then she said, you know, her husband isn't, he's not Catholic. I don't even know if he's baptized, and he just has nothing to do with God. He's very respectful to faith, but I don't think anything is. So she said, I wouldn't, she said he was willing to get married in the church, but I didn't want to make him do that when he doesn't believe.
So the net result then is that she's steamed at you. You're a basket case, or at least you were. You're sad that your friendship is suffering this way. But it sounds as though you handled everything with aplomb, and you were clear, and you didn't back down. You were loving, but you were also not compromising. I think these are all, I mean, I can't imagine giving you any better advice than what you've already done, as painful as it is.
Oh. So I don't regret what I did. I may have regret how much I cried or hyperventilated,
mm-hmm.
but and I don't regret anything that I said, because I knew it had to be said, and I didn't lie, and even if some things went over her head. But however, even if I've damaged our relationship, because she hasn't spoken to me since, even if I've damaged our relationship, I'm afraid that I pushed her further away from the church. Like I said, she didn't really have one foot in the door before, but at least she could, she was part of our lives, and she's seen the witness that me and my husband and our four beautiful children are, and she's seen, you know, like I said, our witness, and she was part of our lives, and there was a hope, you know, even when we were not a child, she'd come to the baptism, and she'd see the beauty of it, but now I just feel, you know, I'm like, I know I'm not here to make peace, Jesus wasn't here to make peace and make friends, and I'm not, gonna go.
Here's something to think about. Let me interject.
I'm afraid I pushed her away from the church, so I'm wondering where can I go from here to try
All right. Okay, let me give you an example. In John chapter 6, the bread of life discourse, you're very familiar with it. Jesus says, I am the bread that comes down from heaven. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you will not have life within you. My flesh is real food. My blood is real drink. You remember all that, right? Well, yeah. At the end of this discourse, what happens? A bunch of people are really irritated with Jesus because he's telling them something that they don't want to accept. And what do? They leave him. What does he do? He just lets them go. He doesn't run after them. He doesn't say, oh, gee, maybe I pushed you further away from the truth and I pushed you away from God. And, you know, that's their free decision to accept or reject. And they rejected him and they walked away. And Jesus doesn't run after them. Now, I'm sure Jesus probably, in his humanity, with his human emotions, he probably felt some sadness. And maybe there were some of those people who walked away from him that he was really maybe closer to and knew them better than some of the others, perhaps. And it was maybe there was some suffering, perhaps, at a human level. But the fact is, I think you are in this position where you've spoken the truth. It did not go over well. She doesn't want to accept it. And now you're left in that position to just let things fall into place, let the cookie crumble, so to speak. And I know that it's easier said than done. And I know that just by my saying it, it's not going to make you feel better emotionally. But perhaps if you meditate on Jesus in John chapter 6 and consider what he went through and the fact that you're, by comparison, not going through anything, you know, quite as dramatic, and take a cue from him, and then just pray for your friend and hope that she will get her mind right as time goes on. And it may well be, Cheryl, that she will not be forgetting you or what you said, and the fact that it bothered her so much may be exactly what God wants to happen in her life so that she will eventually come to her senses. And maybe in due time, she'll thank you, you know?
I pray that, like I said, I don't want the church to seem as, you know, judgmental or bigots or like, oh, we were frowning upon you because of this, that, or the other thing. And I tried to justify it, but like I said, the conversation was just so emotional. I don't know how much of it actually.
Well, let me offer a little word of advice here. We've reached a point in our society where people are on such a hair trigger and they're so hypersensitive that somebody somewhere might say something to disagree with them. Or that somebody might judge them, or that somebody might say that what you're doing is wrong. And I mean, there have to be some sane people like you who are saying, you know what, maybe that's exactly what you need. Maybe what you really need is for somebody to tell you that what you're doing is wrong, because nobody has the gumption to do that. And I don't like doing it, but what you're doing is wrong. Well, how dare you tell me what I'm doing is wrong? And who are you? You're being judgmental. Aren't you judging me? Aren't you, not you, obviously, but when somebody tells you that you're being judgmental and you are intolerant and you're judging them and all of the above, well, that's exactly what they're doing to you, the very thing that they object to you doing. So people can't stand the very suggestion that maybe they might be wrong in what they're doing. Because if they're wrong, that means they'll have to change, or at least they'll have to live with a guilty conscience. So it's easier to go after the people who make a point that, well, this is wrong, and then make them the bad guys when they're not the bad guys at all. They're just the ones who are explaining how things really are. And, you know, it's a thankless task, Cheryl.
Yeah, and so I'm very close with my mother, and obviously she's my cousin, so, and we're from a small town of 100 people, so this is going to, everybody's going to know that I refuse to be your bridesmaid,
so
and
be
refuse
it.
To go to the wedding.
So be it. So be it.
So my mom says to me,
let it rip, Cheryl. Let it rip. This is not on you. This is not your fault. She has to own this. She's the one who's doing something wrong, not you. So let it rip.
Well, I just wanted to say, my mom said, you know, Cheryl, there's going to be lots of times in your life where you're going to have to do something you're not okay with. I said, no. No, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't.
Hang in there, Cheryl. I admire you. And I can only imagine you're going through some real emotionally difficult times right now, but it'll smooth out. It'll get better. And you're doing the right thing. God bless you.
Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149.
You got it.
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
You got it. I think they took like a moon launch, a moon landing, and they turned into a song. You got it. I saw this on Twitter. I want to share it with you. This is from Thomas Williams. It's an infographic. It says, pro-choice, embezzlement is a choice, rape is a choice, human trafficking is a choice, larceny is a choice, molesting children is a choice. Some choices, in quotes, are simply evil and should be illegal. Killing unborn children is that sort of choice. No one is simply pro-choice.
That is powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, are you pro-choice when it comes to embezzlement? Should people be pro-choice when it comes to rape or any of the other things? No. I mean, you can choose to do that and that'll land you in prison, as it rightfully should, but should somebody be supported in that choice? Should somebody be encouraged in that choice or even celebrated in that choice? No, because it's evil, as is abortion. The simplest things often are the most powerful, if you ask me, Cyrus. So I just retweeted that if you want to check it out.
Yeah, that's, it's on Twitter. That is awesome, and that's so true. It's simple, but it hits you right in the face.
Yeah, but you have the screamers out there. Yeah. You know, they can't stop screaming about it.
I don't know where it went, but someone had posted earlier something about, you know, it's a fetus until it's born or something. And so whenever I see something like that, I just post the this is a baby video that we did a couple years ago. And
our response to CNN.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. They handed us a gift with that. And I don't think they even fully understand how they shot themselves in the foot with that. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll play that later today. We'll see.
All right, I'll get it ready.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to John in Massachusetts. Hi, John.
Hi. This thing about the master bedroom sounds really weird. Making it a primary bedroom, so instead of being the master of the house, I would be the primary of my house because I sleep there.
True.
And the master's degree, changing that to a primary degree, sounds like they graduated from grade school. Primary school.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't really work for that, does it?
You erased 10 years of their education.
Well, I do have a master's degree, and I'm rather fond of it. I worked hard to get it, and I don't want to be canceled out because, you know, because it's ridiculous. That's why. That's the bottom reason, the bottom line reason. The whole thing is ridiculous.
Many things today are, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's all I wanted to say.
You got it, John. Are you a real estate agent?
No.
Okay. I bet you'd be a good one because you don't go along with the prevailing insanity. Thank you. Let's go to Elizabeth now in Chicago. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Patrick. Good morning. How you doing?
I am well, thank you.
Great. Hey, my question is, I was listening to that girl that had called in earlier about the wedding.
Yeah.
And if somebody isn't Catholic, like they're a different religion, Jewish, whatever, what is the proper protocol? Proper Catholic protocol? Can you go to the wedding?
Yeah, and here's the thing about it. Let me give you some background. I understand your question. I think you'll find this interesting. We're working with the 1983 Code of Canon Law. Prior to that, I'm going to have to double check. I think it was the 1915 Code that was replaced or updated with the current Code of Canon Law. Now, in my reading of the literature from canon lawyers on this topic, my understanding is that in the prior code of canon law, getting married at the beach or in the forest or in some other place other than the church was not something that would invalidate the wedding. And when the code was changed in 1983, the law was updated to include now the fact that that would be an invalid wedding if a Catholic were to be married without permission, without a dispensation, say from the bishop, at the beach or at a park or something like that. That would now invalidate the wedding. And so some canon lawyers that I've read on this topic have said that, you know, an unintended side effect, which originally was designed to try to protect the sacrament of holy matrimony and encourage strongly Catholics to be married in the church in front of a witness, you know, that's authorized by the church. But it had the net effect, in essence, of causing this situation where you got lots and lots of invalid marriages now, because you've got Catholics who just simply ignore what the church teaches on this issue. So that was an unintended side effect. And one of the solutions that I have seen raised in some canon law circles is for the code to be revised to remove that as a requirement for a valid marriage for a Catholic, and then we'll see what happens. I don't know, and I'm not a canon lawyer, so I can only try to follow the discourse from a distance, but that's one of the details in the background that has a bearing on this issue. So in the case of a baptized Catholic, whether getting married to another baptized person or, you know, with a dispensation perhaps to marry somebody who's not baptized, a Catholic can go if the person, the Catholic being married, has received permission from the bishop and or is using the proper canonical form for holy matrimony. Now, if a Catholic doesn't do that, if a Catholic says, no, I don't want to do that, now she or he is putting herself or himself into an objectively sinful situation. So in that situation, I as a Catholic would not go to the wedding reception or to the wedding, because it would be condoning something that is for that person objectively evil. Now, what about two atheists? Yes, you can go to the wedding. Two Muslims? Yes. What about a Hindu and a Muslim, or a Jew and a Hindu getting married? Yes. What about two Jews getting married? Yes. What about people who have no interest in God whatsoever? I guess those would be atheists. Can you go to their wedding? The answer is yes. And the reason is that marriage as an institution was hallowed by God before any religion. So it's a natural institution established by God, and it is a naturally good thing for people who can get married to get married. So there's no constriction or restriction on you as a Catholic in attending any of those weddings under the circumstances. But where it becomes problematic is a Catholic who, by virtue of being Catholic, has the wherewithal to receive holy matrimony, the sacrament. The Catholic has an obligation that these other parties do not have. The Catholic has an obligation because marriage is a public act and it involves the whole church. The church has a say in how the sacrament is to be celebrated. And so that obligation, when the person who is Catholic ignores or flouts this obligation, that's why for that person it becomes a significant problem, and which is why we would say that, well, I wouldn't go to that in that case. But in the other examples of marriage between other people who are not baptized Catholics, you would be free to go. And that's kind of a roundabout way of answering your question, but I think I got to the heart of your question. Did I, Elizabeth?
Yes, you did. In other words, the way I hear it's like, if you're a baptized Catholic, you have an obligation to get married in the Catholic Church. And if you're deviating from that, it's not a valid marriage.
Right. That's correct. Under the current code of canon law, that's true. Now, there are exceptions. I mean, war and devastation and a lack of a priest anywhere nearby. So the church foresees scenarios where you can validly be married under extreme circumstances. But just because, you know, the woman who's getting married wants to get married at the beach, that's not a sufficient reason to not get married according to the canonical form.
Understood. Thanks for that clarity, Patrick. Have a great
You're welcome. Thanks, Elizabeth. And, you know, if you listen to this show long enough, back me up on this, Cyrus. This is a question that comes up a lot, doesn't it? A lot.
A lot.
Yeah. It's just a lot of people have questions about this. A very good book by a canon lawyer. His name is Ed Peters. The book is called, 100 Answers to Your Questions on Annulments. I'll get the exact book. But there are a lot of people who don't really know what the church's teaching is on this issue. And so to have a good book, here it is. It's Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. Now, the guy who wrote this is a canon lawyer. I think he's also a civil lawyer, if I'm not mistaken. But he's a canon lawyer. He teaches canon law at Sacred Heart Seminary. And so this book is arranged in a question and answer format. And it has got, over the course of 11 chapters, it's got answers to practically any question that somebody might have about marriage, divorce and remarriage, annulments, etc. Here are the chapters. Basic annulment questions, officials in the process, where can annulment cases be heard, when an annulment might be needed, questions on eligibility to file annulment cases, possible grounds for an annulment, questions from and about the former spouse, questions from and about witnesses in an annulment case, the effects of an annulment, what if the answer is no. There's a chapter on miscellaneous questions, and quite a bit more there. So if this is a topic of interest to you or somebody you care about, and you're Catholic or the person is Catholic and you want to know what specifically does the church say, I would recommend this book. It's quite good. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Linda in Texas. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Here's my question. I receive a lot of mail from different Catholic organizations that I do not belong to. And right. On the envelope, there may be a picture of Mary or St. Jude or St. Anthony. Mm-hmm. If there's a holy card or a medal or something, I take that to our Catholic thrift shop. But Somebody told me, or maybe I read it, that I'm not supposed to throw this mail away, either burn it or bury it. I need your advice because I have three small bags of all this Catholic from different organizations that I don't belong to. What is your advice?
Yes, I have the same problem because, like you, I get tons and tons of mail. Most of it goes into the trash can because it's junk mail. So this is what I do. If it's a holy card, an image of Mary or Jesus, I will take that out and throw everything else away and maybe give that to my grandchildren or save it and put it in the vestibule in the parish for somebody who might want to have a holy card. And the pastor's fine with that. So if you bring that into your parish, your pastor would probably say that that's fine, you know, put it in a basket where people can get it. What I typically do would be I have a shredder in my office, and so that an image that might otherwise be, you know, disrespected in some way or sitting in a garbage dump or something, I'll just run it through the shredder, and then it's no longer an image. It's tiny little bits of confetti. And so for me, that's how I dispose of it. You could burn things like that if you wanted to. You could bury them. And I know that there is a long history of disposing of sacramentals, like, say, old rosaries or statues and things like that. Burning or burying is considered a customary way of doing that. But it's not the only way. The main thing is that you have the right sentiment and you want to show proper respect for these holy images. So doing something like that is a good thing as opposed to just tossing them in the trash. That's my thinking.
Well, thank you, because, yes, I didn't want to do anything that would be sacrilegious because, now, I do receive rosaries, but I take them to the church and give them away. But I do have a shredder, Patrick, and I just didn't feel right throwing a beautiful picture of Mary or St. Anthony in the garbage.
I feel the same way. Yeah, it makes me unhappy. I don't want to do it. So, I mean, certainly if it's something that's blessed, obviously you want to take extra care. But so much of the junk mail has, you know, images of Mary or Jesus on it. So for me, and this is, I mean, I think that you can be creative, but for me, putting it in the shredder is the easiest way to make sure that it's, that some disrespect will not come to that picture. And then I have a clear conscience. I don't have to worry about it.
Okay. Thank you so much. That makes me feel a lot better.
You're welcome, Linda. God bless you.
Hey, Patrick.
Yeah.
You know, I've wrestled with that too, and I've come to the conclusion that it's the people sending me this junk mail that are really to blame for throwing these images away.
Yeah.
And so is that okay?
Well, I mean, because you're not asking for it. You're not requesting this information. It just comes to you.
Right. And they're literally sending me junk mail with sacred images on it. That's not cool.
No, it's not. Now, I can see the other side where they're saying, look, we're marketing our Catholic calendar, or we're marketing our whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it's part of what we do. It's part of our apostolate. I can see their point as well.
And we know we're going to grab the attention of fellow believers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, you're onto something important here, Cyrus. There is a psychological and verified scientifically phenomenon in which if you put something of any kind of value, even very modest value, in the junk mail that you send out, there's a certain percentage of people who will feel morally obligated to respond to you with a donation or to purchase something because they feel obligated.
That's diabolical.
Well, I don't know if it's diabolical, but it's manipulative.
All right, and that's a nicer word.
Yeah, and social scientists have studied this phenomenon. I don't have a study at my fingertips, but they can be found, where they've studied the psychology of people, and in particular older people, and in particular older women. They know that a certain percentage will open the envelope, and because, oh, there's a holy card here, or, oh, look, they gave me return address labels with my name and a picture of Jesus the Good Shepherd on them, they know that a certain percentage of those people will feel obligated, and then they will follow through with whatever they're looking for, a donation or a purchase or something like that. So there is a scientific dimension to all this, and to the extent that these mailing houses are sophisticated, they know that by putting these things in, you know, the tchotchke things that often go into these mailings, that they will get a certain response rate. And, you know, maybe that gets to your point about what responsibility do they have in this.
Right. Not cool.
I noticed that the picture I gave you of me is no longer in your office. And you have a shredder. I noticed that too.
It's on my fridge at home.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's good.
Just let me know before you come over.
Okay. And suddenly it won't be on the fridge.
It will be on the fridge. So when you come over, it will be on the fridge.
All right. I know what I'm going to look for first. We do need to take a break. And when I come back, I'll share briefly with you some specifics, in this case, from the Diocese of Superior in Wisconsin, when it comes to how to dispose of religious items. I'll share that with you when we come back, right after this.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
I promised you a little insight, in this case from the Diocese of Superior, Wisconsin, on how to dispose of religious items. So we'll get straight to that. It references the Code of Canon Law, Canon 1171. It says, once a religious object is blessed and dedicated for divine worship or veneration, it must be treated with reverence and must not be used in either an improper or profane way. What happens when the rosary or statue breaks and is irreparable? Or when the palm dries out and the following Palm Sunday provides you with a new palm. The basic rule for the disposition of these items is to burn or bury them. Therefore, the normal rule of thumb is that anything that has been blessed should be burned and then the ashes buried, or just simply burned. A second option As a Catholic, collecting sacramentals such as votive candles, religious pictures, rosaries, which sometimes break, medals, palm branches, and other miscellaneous religious items is fairly common. What do you do if you're unsure if they're blessed? One option, if they are unusable, is to give them, if they're still usable, rather, is to give them away to other people who could use them. If you can't find any takers, there are other options. The proper disposal of votive candles and other devotionals, if they have been blessed, is to burn or to bury them, most preferably the former in the case of candles. Letting candles burn down entirely, or if this presents a hazard, should the glass candle holders break, burn them by themselves. It is not a sin to throw away blessed items, but out of proper respect, one should dispose of them in this way. If devotionals have not been blessed, and this is gets to the heart of the question that came up earlier, what about all the tchotchke stuff that comes in the mail that you didn't ask for? So in a case of something that hasn't been blessed, such as some of the holy cards and such that come through the mail, those are simply pictures and can be thrown away. If you feel uncomfortable throwing them away, you can burn or bury them as well. And I proposed a third option, which would be put them through the shredder. Items that should not be shared. Any liturgical items that are obviously damaged or worn beyond their ability to function worthily. If the items are burnable, they should be burned. If possible, the ashes should be collected and buried on church grounds or in a Catholic cemetery. If the items can't be burned, they should be disassembled or destroyed in a way that prevents any profane reuse and then buried on the church grounds, such as in a Catholic cemetery. And it gives a few other suggestions about how to safely burn something. And so those are the basic do's and don'ts when it comes to items that are either blessed or not blessed. And we'll get a link to this. And this, again, courtesy of the Diocese of Superior in Wisconsin. We thank them for that. And we'll have a link to this on the show Twitter feed so you can read it for yourself. Let's go to Mary, who's waiting patiently in Nebraska. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
I have a question. Is it okay to make a donation to a private Christian school that my grandchildren attend? And it's not Catholic.
Mm-hmm. So it's the local Lutheran school or the local Baptist academy, something like that?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you're making a donation to help enhance the situation for the benefit of your grandchildren who are going to school there, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, I don't see that as a problem in itself. I would be attentive to, you know, other aspects. Does this school promote anti-Catholic views? Does this school target Catholic children or make them feel alienated or go after them for not being Protestant? I mean, those are questions I would want to have answered. And if it was a school that didn't engage in any of those kinds of things and was just giving a good education that was led by Protestant folk as opposed to Catholic folk, if you're giving them a donation to help pay their teachers well or to keep the lights turned on or make sure the kids have food, I think that's entirely benign and no reason not to do that. And you have a vested interest, right?
I do. And they were in Catholic schools before, but in junior high, they made a switch because of educational opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so.
Yeah, I think it's good under the circumstances. Now, if you didn't have any connection with that school, you just liked them, and you had a choice of where to make your financial donations, as a Catholic, I would make my donation first to a Catholic entity, you know, but since you have grandchildren going there and you want their experience to be as good as possible, I see that as entirely plausible, entirely reasonable.
All right. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, Mary. Thank you. Well, let's see. Let's keep going. Let's go now to Cynthia listening in Austin, Texas. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, my friend.
Hello.
So I have a good... Hi, can you hear me? Hello?
When you say hello and I say hello back, that's all I'm doing. I'm not asking you if you can hear me. I'm just saying hello back to you. That's all. Welcome.
Oh, I thought you couldn't hear me. Thank you. I have a little solution. I have a little solution for the prayer cards. They are a perfect evangelization tool for a homeless ministry. at my parish, people save them, and I pick them up and pass them out on the street, mainly Divine Mercy cards and cards with Our Lady. But I'll take almost any prayer card because they're easy to carry, and people on the street, Patrick, love to have them. Most people, I would say 8 out of 10 people, and they're happy to have them, especially with little prayers. And it's like throwing a little stone in that evangelization pool. It's a ripple effect. I've had people say, do you have a bag of those and I can just pass them out to other people? Mm-hmm. That's happened.
That's neat.
That's really just good. An idea. It's just an idea. It works. And if your parish doesn't have a street ministry, maybe it probably needs one. And I know that's easier to say than do. And I know that it's not everybody's call. Mm-hmm. A sister told me that, actually. But, so that's all. Yep.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I like and I appreciate your apostolate of handing out holy cards. That's a great thing, especially for the kiddos. Good for them to have these images around them. Thank you. Let's go now to Sheila in Jensen Beach, Florida. Excuse me. Hi, Sheila.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. I know you don't have much time. Anyway, my brother-in-law died in February, end of February, and on his bedside, you know, when he's dying, he told his daughter, just his daughter, that he wanted his ashes scattered at a Catholic college that he and my sister attended and actually got married at.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I tried to bring it up that, you know, it needs to be in a sacred spot. You can't just sprinkle ashes anywhere. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, well, Sheila, you know, we're not as Catholic as you are, and it's just kind of bothering me. I think I know everything, but I don't. I'm trying to be a real Catholic here,
mm-hmm.
you know?
And that's good.
And
so just let them know that you're not trying to be better than them or smarter than them, but you're just letting them know that the church forbids the scattering of ashes for the remains of a baptized Catholic. And if they want to go against what the church says on this issue, that's between them and God. And they shouldn't hate you because you're telling them what the church says. But they should at least be aware that the church says not to do that. And if they want to ignore the church's teaching, that's, like I say, that's between them and God. But you're not doing anything wrong by informing them of that.
Yes, it just bothers me because they'll say stuff like they're cafeteria Catholics, and that just really bothers me because I don't think you can be a cafeteria Catholic. I think you have to be a whole Catholic.
Well, here's what I would say. If they're glorying in that, I'd say, well, good luck. I hope that works out for you. Because what did Jesus say?
Right.
Jesus says, why do you say to me, Lord, Lord, but do not do what I command you? And it's not the one who says to me, Lord, Lord, who will enter the kingdom of heaven. It's the one who does the will of my Father. What is the will of the Father? Well, we hear the Father's voice on Mount Tabor, the Mount of Transfiguration, when Jesus is transfigured in the presence of Peter, James, and John. And what do we hear the Father say? He says, this is my beloved Son. Listen to him. So you can just explain to your brother-in-law or your, you know, his relatives, just say, you know, I'm not here to make you do anything. But if you know that God wants one thing and you're not willing to do it, or he doesn't want this and you're going to do it anyway, that's between you and him, and eventually you'll have to answer for it. So I hope it works out for you.
Right.
Good luck. You're going to need it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, and I want to let you know that I've bought several of your books, and I can listen to you all day long.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you. Not everybody feels like you do, Sheila, but I'm glad you feel that way.
You're very, very smart, and you're a gift from God. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. Let's see if we can get to Larry in Monterey, California. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
Yes, how can I help?
Yes, I was wondering, is it a sin to be gay? Will you still go to heaven if you're gay?
When you say gay, what do you mean by that?
That you've had sex with men.
Well, let me tell you what the Bible says, and maybe you can judge for yourself. 1 Corinthians 6, beginning in verse 9, says, do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will enter the kingdom of God. And such were some of you. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God. So it seems to me that's a pretty direct answer to your question. What do you think?
Okay. Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. And I would just draw everyone's attention back to that passage. Note that it's not singling out homosexuals. This is true for all people, whether you are homosexual or heterosexual. And most of the sins here are not sexual. Drunkenness, reviling, swindling, greed, thievery. There's a lot there, and it's not singling out any particular group of people. This is for all of us. I'll leave it at that. That, by the way, was 1 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 9. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow, as usual. I can't wait. 21 hours from now, we'll do it again. In the meantime, please pray for me, and I'll pray for you. God bless you.